Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Now we're in depth on the harrowing, rewarding, expensive quest to conceive. In the midst of Belle Boggs' efforts to get pregnant, she experienced a vivid ache so powerful that she called it child longing. More than anything, she wrote, this is what I wanted, to have a child of my own, be clung to in a way that primate infants have, legs wrapped around my middle, a hand in my hair. By that time, she and her husband Richard had been through difficult and sometimes painful fertility treatments. They'd spent a lot of money. And they'd experienced several times the despair that all of it might not work. In the end, one of the fertility methods was successful, and Boggs and her husband have a daughter. But she learned a lot about the longing and the business of trying to become a parent. As Belle and specialist Dr. Janie Jensen join us, I'd like to hear from you. If you've turned to fertility specialists to help you conceive, was the experience what you expected? Was it confusing and disappointing? What do you wish you'd known going in? So as we talk with our guests this morning, we're going to be talking about some of the fertility methods that are being used today. I think your own experience would inform this conversation. If you've turned to fertility specialists and methods to help you conceive, what was the experience like? What do you wish you'd known going in that you know now? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Steph Curtis is at nprnews.org/live, and I'm on Twitter, and I've tweeted out a couple questions on this. It's at Carrie NPR. Belle Boggs is a writer and the author of the memoir, The Art of Waiting, on fertility, medicine, and motherhood, and she's with us today in Durham, North Carolina. Belle, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Carrie.
Dr. Janie Jensen is with us. She's an infertility specialist at Mayo Clinic, and she joins us from Rochester. And Dr. Jensen, welcome to you. Do you mind if I call you Janie for the conversation?
Please.
Would that be all right?
No, I would really appreciate if you did that.
Okay. Thanks very much. Good to have you here. Belle, in the end, is it right to say that your waiting, this quest to conceive, took 47 months?
Yes. Well, it took about 5 years, and we were eventually successful through IVF, and I now have a daughter who will turn 3 at the end of the month. I do recognize that this is not always the case for everyone. Many people pursue ART and find that they can't continue to afford it. They can't afford it in the first place, or they are unsuccessful and disappointed, and they turn to other forms of Plan B family making. That's a term that I discovered in researching the book that was coined by the legal scholar Martha Ehrtman, and she uses that term not to refer to second choices, but to different choices, different paths to family. So that's part of what I was exploring as I was researching my book.
Yeah, Belle, I got the sense in reading the memoir that in this time, these 47 months, you and your husband were kind of in this suspended animation. I mean, you're living your lives, of course, but As informs the title of your book, the waiting, the kind of suspended life that you lived in. I can't imagine how exhausting that is, how draining that is for you two.
It was, and it was for many people I know, many friends of mine. One of the things that I did that was enormously helpful, but also that kind of contributed to my feeling that, you know, this was this very different time in our lives, was I attended a support group, Resolve, the National Infertility Association. They host support groups that are free and open to anyone who's going through this time. You can find them on resolve.org on their website. And if there isn't one in your area, you can offer to start one. So we attended the support group, and, you know, our support group would grow and it would shrink as people were successful or decided to leave treatment. And, you know, we were there for quite some time, for more than 2 years, I think. And it was very helpful. And it was this kind of once a month time that we could go during this very isolating time and sit around a table with a group of other women and men and talk about the isolating experience of infertility.
Janie, I want to know how physicians such as yourself, and you might be working, I assume, with a couple for many, many months. How do you counsel a couple who may be just embarking on this, you know, to understand that this could be a long process and what this is going to be like? Will you tell me some of the things that you talk about?
Yeah. First, let me say I absolutely love this book. I thought it was so real and eloquently written. And there was one part in particular that was fairly early on, but the quote I'm paraphrasing is essentially, you know, if someone had told me in 5 years you'll have a baby, I would have been fine to wait those 5 years. And I can't even tell you the number of times I've had a similar conversation with a patient, and particularly once she's been successful, where we'll look back and say, man, if we had had a crystal ball when we started this process and knew what was going to turn out, it would be okay to go through those dark times. But not knowing that is something that's incredibly difficult. And one thing I say very, very often to patients is, especially those that come in with a partner, is for most couples who undergo fertility treatment, I think it's fair to say that they would each be their other's sort of closest confidant and support person. But when you're going through this, you're both struggling with the same problem. And victim isn't the right word, but it's hard to be someone's rock and also kind of be going through something that causes a difficulty or suffering at the same time. So I usually recommend that couples have some kind of outside support, a person outside of their dyad that they can talk to about this. Resolve is a phenomenal organization, or even sometimes professional counseling.
You know, Janie, I was thinking about that you see so much hope and longing in your office, right? And no one wants to crush that. And yet you must have to be somewhat resolute with couples about, I want you to be clear that this is the percentage, the chance of, you know, those kinds of things. So I'm interested in how you calibrate the reality of this with so much longing and wanting, the kind that Bell describes in the book.
I think with time, I've become better at having those really difficult conversations with patients and taking away hope. I agree, is hope. I mean, if any patients or current or former patients are listening, I mean, I hope I've never done that to anyone here, because I think that would be absolutely terrible to take that away from people. But you have to be in a situation sometimes where things are long shots, and to realistically say the chance of this working is 5% or 10%, because the painful reality of our fertility treatments is that in the best case scenario, IVF is only successful probably 65% of the time. Yeah. Now, cumulatively, if you kept having unlimited resources, and the resources I usually talk about with patients are, you know, your time, your emotion, and your financial resources, and everyone's pie for that is split into different sections. But if you kept doggedly returning and trying again and again, cumulatively, most people will be successful. But as I think the book pointed out well, not everyone can keep kind of getting back on the horse and trying again and again.
Right. Let me take a call here from Hoy in Minneapolis. Hey, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Hi. It sounds like you've had some experience with this.
I have. I share a similar story. My wife and I had quite the journey to pregnancy. It was about almost 5 years as well. Mm. And we went through just about everything in regards to the challenges of conceiving. And I wanted to mention, because you'd asked, you know, what your experience was and how it affected us. And I will say, you know, we were this power couple with a plan in place. We knew exactly what we wanted. We were preparing for it emotionally, psychologically, physically, financially. And we knew exactly when we were going to start trying. And unfortunately, what we didn't know, what we didn't plan for, was not being able to conceive. And it really rocked us, you know. it really drained us emotionally. And like I said, we had tried everything from organic diet to acupuncture to therapy. We went to Resolve as well. They were very, very helpful for us. And ultimately, I think, you know, just the resilience and struggling well together every day got us through it. And we are expecting in January, actually, the 29th.
Wow. Congratulations.
That's wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you. And so, yeah.
I wanted to say, when you said it really rocked us, I mean, this is something that Bell writes about, too. Just this identity about who we are. It sounds like it, you know, it makes you see yourself a little differently.
It does. And it changed us for the better. My wife and I are stronger now than ever before. And, you know, to get through what we've been through, and it's different for everybody, but it made us stronger. And I'll tell you, you know, I spent a decade in corporate America doing strategy development, but this experience made me realize that I was unhappy with my life too, because I had planned all this stuff out and we were ready and we had this plan in place, but it didn't work out. So it did affect my identity. And actually I changed careers. I'm back at school getting my master's in nursing.
Wow.
Because I was so just excited about the process, but I met such great people. I knew that what I was doing could make a difference on the medical side too. So it really, truly just, it tore us down for a little while, but after getting through it, we were just stronger now than ever, and we have a better sense of life.
Boy, I'm really glad you heard the show and you called, Hoy. Thank you. So, Belle, what are you hearing that?
That's just, well, it's a wonderful story, and I love also the description of Hoy's career change, too. It is so inspiring to be around medical professionals and other people who are working so hard to help other people. I think at different times in researching my book, I've wanted to be an evolutionary biologist and a nurse and, you know, an embryologist, and obviously all those things are pretty much out of my reach at this point, but it's very exciting to be around other people who are working so hard for others and for the dreams of others. I also heard that the description of identity. One of the people I interviewed is a therapist who specializes in grief counseling and also in fertility counseling in New York, and her name is Marnie Rosner. And she described infertility as an assault to your identity. And I thought that was just a really succinct and powerful way of describing what it felt like to have these plans that start when you're a child, when you grow up in your own family and you think, oh, I'm going to one day be, you know, a mother, I'm going to be a father, I'm going to, you know, this is certainly not true for everyone, but it is true for many people. And I spent years as a K-12 teacher, so I observed this in my own students who thought that they would have families that looked very much like the families that they grew up in. So when you realize that you're going to have this long road ahead that may end in living child-free, it may end in adoption. It may end in pursuing ART or pursuing different forms of, you know, of family building, maybe through donor egg, donor embryo. There's still this part of your identity that had planned differently, had not thought about this, you know, this maybe, you know, plan B parenting that you would have ahead. And there are, as Hoy was really eloquently describing, there are so many obstacles in our paths. There are financial obstacles. Only 15 states mandate some kind of insurance coverage for fertility care. There are, for many people, legal obstacles. It's more challenging for LGBT families to adopt in many places. And there are these emotional obstacles, growing up with this narrative, this kind of pronatalist narrative that, you know, it's good to have children, you know, and this is a thing that should happen naturally. This is a thing that should happen, you know, without medical intervention.
Oh, yes.
Or without these outside efforts.
Belle, I've already heard from people on Twitter about that. Yeah.
Yeah. These narratives can be very isolating. So there was another phrase that I really liked that Rosner cited in her work, which was a long-term study of the experiences of women who had kind of moved on after unsuccessful infertility treatment. And that was, she didn't coin this phrase, she was quoting it from, I think, Kenneth Doka, and that's the phrase disenfranchised grief, which is a grief that can't be expressed outwardly, and so therefore can't be socially supported. So something that we can't talk about around other people, that we can't share with other people because we feel shame, or we feel that it's not something that's okay to discuss, is this very painful and challenging experience for many people. And I think it, I think that she connected it very wisely to the experience of infertility.
Yeah, let me go back to some calls here. And to remind you, as you listen in this morning, it's a conversation about infertility, fertility treatments, the waiting, the expense of it, what it does to change you, your own identity and your perception of your identity as a couple, with your partners, just some of the new advances in fertility medicine. Belle Boggs with us as we talk about this. She's the author of The Art of Waiting on Fertility Medicine and Motherhood. And Dr. Janie Jensen is with us. She's an infertility specialist at Mayo and director of Mayo Clinic Assisted Reproductive Technology, with us from Rochester. I'm asking you this morning, if you've turned to fertility specialists to help you conceive, I want to know about the quality of that experience. Was it what you expected? Was it kind of confusing? Was it disappointing? What do you wish you'd known going in that you know now? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Steph Curtis is hanging out at the live page. And Steph, what are you hearing?
Cassie says, I've seen Dr. Jensen, our guest, for IVF during our 6.5-year-long marathon to conceive. We were lucky it finally worked, but it is emotionally, physically, and financially draining. Pills, raging hormones, bills, injections, ultrasounds, miscarriage. It's incredibly straining personally and on a relationship. We have a great 3-year-old kiddo, but it's a hard road with no guarantees.
Wow. To Deborah in Champlin. Hi, Deborah. Sounds like you've been through this too. Hi.
I have for many years. And I have something that I medically wanted to share that I think might affect many people, even just listening to this. I'll be really brief about my story, though. I was married, and we lost a baby unexpectedly at about 5 months in the womb, and so a second trimester miscarriage, and I was in my mid to early 30s and wasn't aware of any fertility problems in any of my family, and just thought that it was, you know, one of those horrible things. In the end, the marriage didn't survive. I moved to the West Coast. I had a boyfriend out there, and he wasn't very much into it, but I did talk him into trying to have one child together. I said, I do all the work, and and thus began the fertility journey, which lasted about 6 years.
In the end,
I had compiled 7 miscarriages. I went to 3 different fertility clinics. I lost the boyfriend, and the last year I went it alone. I gave a Hail Mary IVF with a donor, and I have 2 twin boys to show for it.
Wow.
In the end, I lost all my savings and ended up being close to $100,000. I'm a single mom, self-employed with a small, you know, payroll job, and poor, and couldn't be happier. But I know what everybody out there who's listening with the pain, I know what you've been through, and I want to share this. Before my last IVF, I went to get a prescription filled, and the group health pharmacist, this is out in Washington State, he says, you do know that the medications that you're filling here contraindicate each other. I said, what? So I have a thyroid, an underactive thyroid, and I was filling my thyroid medication and my progesterone and estrogen. And in the end, the thyroid medicine decreases the efficacy of your hormonal medications by, some people say, approximately 4-fold. So I'm heading towards this last IVF, And I ran up to Seattle on the advice of a friend, really seriously, and within about 2 weeks, he had quintupled my thyroid medication. It was the only pregnancy that I ever had that went well, where I didn't miscarry. Because I had IVF and then miscarriages after them. I seemed to be able to get pregnant, but not to keep.
So Deborah, do forgive me, please, for interrupting. We do have other people that want to talk about this. Is your essential point, congratulations that it worked, is your point that maybe knowing more about, you know, whatever medication, more transparency about
thyroid.
Yeah.
Well, specifically thyroid. There's a lot of thyroid problems out there, and none of my fertility clinics even knew I had a thyroid problem.
Okay. So Janie, this might be what I was suggesting about the confusing part. You know, you get into the whirl of this, and it's confusing to try to keep track of everything that you're doing with your physicians. Can you speak to that?
Sure. First, I would say we are very aware of the interaction of the thyroid on fertility, and that is something I aggressively look at for patients. Your story is very powerful. I'm also very glad you're successful. I'm not aware of any medical references that support the point of negative interaction. I don't know the specifics of the story, but I am not aware of I don't want other listeners to hear that there is a negative interaction necessarily between very necessary thyroid hormone replacement and some of the fertility medicines we need. But what I'm hearing from this story and what I see from many patients is people are very hungry for information about their condition. And so I'll frequently have patients that will have just done extensive research on supplements, diets, conditions about the endocrine system that are rare, and we hear a lot of questions and comments like this. So I agree there's a wealth of information, some accurate, some not, that's available at patients' fingertips now.
Janie, I wanted to ask you about something that Bell says in the book, which is that we in the Western world view conception, quote, as mysterious, even magical, which means, though, when you turn to science, that kind of feels like it's anything but magical. Where do these perceptions, why do these perceptions linger about this idea of conception, that we can't really know what it's fully about, that there's some kind of magic behind it?
Well, I mean, maybe it ties to some of the historical, Christian-based values of the U.S., and I'm not sure where, you know, sex is something passive we're not supposed to enjoy or have, and, you know, you suffer through this to be rewarded with a baby. And by the way, I don't believe any of those things, but... but, you know, maybe there's something, almost anti-feminist in that movement,
yeah,
where, you know, you're taking, we're taking charge of your reproductive cycle is shameful, even when you're trying to not get pregnant or be pregnant. I wonder if
right.
There's some root in that.
Belle, do you think that might be true?
I think so. And I mean, what I kind of came to conclude and personally is that it felt to me like these narratives that we absorb, you know, consciously or unconsciously, can really be described as anti-choice narratives, right? That, you know, this pregnancy is this thing that happens to you and you're just supposed to accept it and passively enjoy it. You're not supposed to pursue it. That pursuit of something, dogged pursuit, as many people who've been through IVF or people who've been through, you know, other forms of, you know, very difficult family building, you know, they know that it's a hard road and you have to advocate for yourself. You have to work very hard to make it happen. And the idea that that's somehow undignified, I think, is something that I thought about a lot, and that, you know, it's not, as I agree with Janie, it's not something that I accept personally, but I recognize it, and I see it more now that I've been through it.
Call here from Lauren in St. Paul. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Carrie.
Sounds
I wanted
like,
to share
yeah.
a surprise that we experienced.
Sure.
We've done four rounds of IVF through the Center for Reproductive Medicine. Their quality of care is absolutely phenomenal. Mm-hmm. But due to the closure of another infertility clinic in the Twin Cities, the waits are extremely long. Every time we had a failed cycle, we needed to wait between 3 and 4 months before we could even begin the next cycle, not because our bodies needed to recover, but because the queue was already so long with other patients. Huh. And that really led to a great degree of anxiety and depression in that time when there was nothing we felt like we could do.
Janie, are you aware of that?
Well, I do know. I am familiar with the situation that she's referring to. And, you know, we'll hear, you know, sometimes it's really difficult to get in. And personally, in my own life, I'm a person that wants action when something happens. So time and time again, when I hear from a patient, I really need to get in, I want to accommodate them to be able to say, yeah, come in tomorrow, because that's what patients want and need. And as much as I can, I try to make that happen.
Lynn says on Twitter, no one tells you when to stop. The feeling is always, but the next procedure could be the one that works. Belle, did you experience that?
You know, I felt like I had very good and very very informed and informative care at UNC Fertility. I had a really good relationship with my doctor. I do think, and I have wondered if the fact that I was writing about this experience long before I, you know, was able to afford, it took me a long time to be able to save up for IVF. And so I've wondered if the fact that I was writing about it sort of affected. I felt like I had just, maybe they just give just wonderful care there and they see everyone immediately and you always see the same doctor. But that was pretty much my experience.
But let me ask you this, Belle. If
yes.
To write to this person that tweeted, I mean, if a doctor had said to you, somewhere through those 47 months that you were involved with this, I really don't think, I think you've come to the end of this. I really don't think this is going to work. How would you have listened to that?
I mean, I think that would have been hard to hear, but I think that as the risk-averse person I am with fairly limited resources, I think I would have heard that. And I know lots of people who've heard similar things and have had to make different kinds of plans and have had to take some time to accept it. I recognize that it's incredibly difficult. It sounds like the person on Twitter is suggesting that, you know, maybe we need to hear more of these sort of pragmatic, difficult conversations that Janie was describing earlier in the hour. For me, I think that I experienced almost the opposite, where my doctor said, you know, I think what's going to work for you is going to be IVF. And it took me a long time to get there because, you know, because of the expense and because of other kinds of hesitations that I had. But I do think how, you know, I would be very interested to hear more from Janie about how those conversations happen and
Janie?
How.
Well, let's
you know,
turn
some
to
people
Janie
also,
on that.
Yeah, sure.
So, Janie, how do you talk to couples to say we might be at the end of this process?
I mean, as you already said, you know, this is a common conversation and an incredibly difficult one. Usually it's not something that is a first conversation. You know, usually we have a lot of history and there are people that I can think of off the top of my head where I have said to patients, you know, I feel like we have let you down. And by we, I really say medicine and science and technology. You know, for all we can do, the thing that's really painful, even as a provider, is that we never can be 100% successful. And I think sometimes those conversations are easier when you put that humanity behind it. Because I very much get involved in the lives of my patients and the successful patients, and even sometimes the unsuccessful patients, are people who just become a deep part of me. And So, you know, my take on it will often be, you know, I feel like as a provider in some way I have let you down, and I'm really sad about that. And I wish that we had something else to offer you, but I'm not sure that we do right now.
You know, see, I understand that. That sounds very compassionate, but it also might, and you know this happens in other parts of the medical community, it also might drive medical treatment in a place that's kind of impractical, right? Because there is this feeling that we can solve this, we the medical community, if only we do this. You know, you go ahead.
Oh, sure. May I speak to something that's happening here in the Triangle that I think is pretty exciting?
Yeah.
So there's a foundation in the Triangle of North Carolina called the Noah Z. M. Goetz Foundation. And it was founded by a couple who experienced unsuccessful long-term infertility treatment and turned to domestic adoption. And they started offering low-cost seminars to give people information about domestic adoption out of their home, basically, and through webinars, and also started a grant program for couples and individuals who had experienced unsuccessful fertility treatment and wanted to pursue domestic adoption. And they have partnered with a number of fertility clinics in the area to offer their seminars so that people can look at other kinds of family building choices and feel like there's another place that they can turn if IVF or other forms of ART are not going to work for them. And I think that their names are Nate and Perul Goetz. And I think that this foundation and this kind of holistic look at, okay, these are other approaches to family building. Jeannie also mentioned the counseling services that she refers people to. I know that some clinics offer counseling as kind of part of the services that they offer. And I think kind of looking at the patient, I mean, you know, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a medical person, but from the many friends that I have, the many people I know who've been through this, seeing that there are multiple options and multiple paths that they can take seems to be really helpful.
Jeannie, how do you feel about that?
Well, we see this quite often. We'll often have patients that are pursuing adoption, and I'm not an adoption expert, but from being part of this, I know some agencies won't allow patients to pursue fertility treatments while they are in the adoption process, but others will. And so I have some people that are kind of doing both simultaneously. And when I have couples maybe that aren't successful in fertility treatment and do build their family through adoption, I mean, that's I love it. I mean, that's also extremely exciting as a provider, an invested person in their family building. And I've written probably dozens of support letters for couples and that they need as a kind of a reference letter for the adoptive process, too.
Dr. Jeannie Jensen with us from Mayo. Bell Boggs with us, author of The Art of Waiting and A Conversation about fertility, the advances in medicine. We haven't really talked about whether the ethics of, those ethical conversations are keeping up with the advances in fertility. I'll ask Dr. Jensen about that on the other side of news. And also hearing your questions and your experiences with this, what you wish you'd known on the way in to perhaps what might have been a long road of fertility treatments. Was the experience what you expected? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. News now with Phil Picardi. And Phil, what are you leading with this hour?
Hi, Carrie. President-elect Donald Trump is huddling with Vice President-elect Mike Pence in Manhattan today as Trump moves closer to filling out his cabinet. Top national security posts are at the forefront. A senior Trump official says former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani has emerged as a favorite for Secretary of State. Former Congressman Mike Rogers has announced his resignation from the Trump transition team. It's a move that could rattle GOP officials worried about Trump's lack of foreign policy credentials. President Obama says the election shows the need to address inequality, economic dislocation, and people's fears their children won't do as well as they have done. At a news conference in Athens, Greece today, Obama said there's a range of factors involved in the election of Trump, but it's clear globalization combined with technology and social media disrupted people's lives. The company building the $3.8 billion Dakota Access oil pipeline is denouncing a decision by the Army Corps of Engineers to delay an easement to cross a Missouri River reservoir in North Dakota. The CEO of Energy Transfer Partners says the decision is motivated purely by politics at the expense of a company that has done nothing but play by the rules. The Corps wants more studies and tribal input before it decides whether to allow the pipeline to proceed. And a member of the board that oversees New York's transit agency has asked it to give more thought to adding safety barriers on subway platforms. 44 people have been killed by trains in the city this year, either by jumping onto the tracks or by being pushed. There were 50 fatalities in 2015. The agency is conducting a pilot program involving an alarm that alerts a train operator when someone is on the tracks. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:41.
On Morning Edition, Kathy Werzer asks the questions that need to be answered.
Do you think there are parallels between Ventura's situation and what Donald Trump is facing now?
There's going to be tremendous distraction.
Tune in weekdays from 4 to 9 on Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, a look at the election playing out in Somalia to seat a new parliament and pick a new president. Then, a conversation about what immigrants in Minnesota are asking about and doing with an uncertain future post-election. All of that at 11.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by our members and by Pentair, the sustainable water partner of the Minnesota Vikings and the Minnesota Twins. Pentair, your water champion. For more information, visit Pentair.com.
Today's programming is sponsored in part by Sue DiNuccio to wish Lydia and Luke a happy 33rd birthday by their mama, DiNucci.
It's Thread Week on the show, which means big ideas and big books all week. And we've got some fun features on the Thread page. Right now, Tracy Mumford is writing about escapist books, astronauts, octopuses, and intrigue. If that isn't clickbait, I don't know what is. And Tracy Mumford will be here a little later to give us the thread question, which is an intriguing one. Back to the conversation this hour. Bell Boggs with us talking about the art of waiting, and Dr. Janie Jensen with us from Mayo. And to the phones to Paul in Minnetonka. Hey, Paul, thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks very much for having me.
Of course. What do you want to say?
So to kind of speak to the experience, my husband and I worked with a gestational carrier here in Minnesota to have our son, who's 9 months old now. And a huge component of that is IVF, of course. And, you know, I guess the experience that we walked away with is, as people, whatever your situation is, are shopping around for your clinics, we chose one here in Minneapolis for convenience of travel and just, you know, it was close by and kind of seemingly easy to work with. What we ended up being really surprised at is how much, I guess I'll say, delayed it seems our process may have been just as a result of clinic scheduling. Simple, you know, you get through one screening, one appointment, and then you're kind of ready for the next step. But, you know, we find out the next, literally the next available appointment is 2 or 3 months for that step.
Yeah.
And we ended up having to go through two cycles. And so the second time that we were going through things, we were a lot more aware and honestly a lot more forceful about saying, you know, we're not going to wait another 3 months to do the next step when it could be done, you know, tomorrow or next week. And through some kind of uncomfortable conversations, move the process along a little bit faster. But we would just, you know, really advise that when you're vetting your clinic, also understand their schedule limitations and what is
very good,
you know, required to wait clinically and required to wait with respect to scheduling.
Yeah, Paul, really glad you called, especially given that call we had earlier about kind of a similar situation. So thank you.
Congratulations.
Hearing from Karen in Eagan this morning. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Carrie. How are you?
Doing well. What was your experience with this?
Yeah, my husband and I went through a 5-year process of infertility treatments, and it was a little unusual for us anyway, because we had established within 3 years of that, I recall our doctor calling us and letting us know we'd gone through a couple of IVF treatments at that point. And I remember being in my kitchen painting it, and he called and said, look, I'm very concerned that this isn't going to work, and have you considered egg donor? And I said, absolutely not. That is not an option for us. And that was it. And we tried some other things in the meantime. But what happened was this process of a mental change and wrapping your mind around a biologic loss.
Right.
And which I never imagined that I would be able to do that. And time and I think just processing that none of the things we had tried had worked, along with a lot of support from my husband and family. And we also were part of a mind-body group here in the Twin Cities that really helped me to kind of bring things down to a level where I could allow other options to be available to me. And it worked.
It worked. I was just going to ask Karen.
But you needed
to spend some time thinking about what you were willing to do.
Right. I needed that time, and I also needed, as you were talking about earlier, having someone say, this isn't working for you, and really, I believe this is your next option. And when we came into the office and sat down and expressed our willingness and desire to go forward with egg donor, I will never forget that my doctor said, if I were your father, this is what I would recommend. Yet never saying that, letting us come to our own conclusion and decision making. Right. And it gave me chills and it made me feel very good moving forward. And we actually ended up, we had a transfer of two embryos and ended up with triplets.
Wow, oh my gosh.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so that's another
congratulations.
Thing to consider with infertility treatment, and it is a blessing, but there is a huge it's a journey, and it is a struggle, and it's emotional, it's physical, it's financial.
Karen,
and we were fortunate.
Thank you so much for the call. Janie, again, this kind of reminds me of something I wanted to ask you about, which is whether the ethical debate about some of these procedures, with all of the implications that I think Karen has reminded us of, is keeping up with the medical advances.
Well, the ethical challenges are one of the things that I love the best about this field, and I think there's so much, it's exciting to talk about, but no. So the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, which is one of our large national organizations and provides guidelines for ethical care of fertility patients, which I follow, they acknowledge that from a legal standpoint, the laws surrounding reproduction are probably about 15 years behind the science and technology. And currently in Minnesota, there's actually a quite frightening movement that's being bandied about within the Minnesota legislature about trying to prohibit women from being gestational carriers, which is what we call when someone else carries a pregnancy for you. But the common lay term is to be a surrogate. That's actually not medically accurate, because a true surrogate is someone that provides eggs and the uterus, but there are ongoing legal challenges with many of the things that we do that are quite successful and ethical.
So, Janie, I know that this U.S. panel of fertility experts recommended the three-parent embryo. So this is a method, correct me if this is not correct, where you use parts of eggs from two women and the sperm from a man, and this is done if a woman has some kind of genetic disease that...
Correct.
Yeah,
yep.
Go ahead.
So this is very exciting technology, and I think to see where this goes in the future will be kind of one of the next frontiers of what we do. But it is especially important for women that have a certain types of genetic conditions where they have mitochondrial disorders or problems with some of the organelles within the cells, and then getting part of the egg removed and part of the egg replaced is the idea that this may be something that can alleviate that condition in offspring and allow these women to have healthy children.
Belle, you wrote about some of the advances that are coming on with this. Do you hear concern about, you know, the medical professionals who are involved in this and, again, wanting to offer some kind of hope, but being concerned that people are not fully aware of what these advances involve?
Well, you know, I always feel a little hesitant when people bring up advances and certainly there are lots of ethical concerns, and I think that what Janie says, that this is exciting and interesting and something we need to pay very close attention to, is, you know, absolutely right. But I think that for people who haven't been through this long, difficult process, there's this sense that you know, it's easy to imagine that people approach medical decisions in this, you know, cavalier Wild West way. And I that has not been my experience or the experience of anyone I've spoken to. And I think that Janie's really right to bring up the need to catch up with some of these advances legislatively so that we can regulate to protect everyone. One of the legal scholars I talked to, Douglas Nishime, who's a law professor, told me, you know, he focuses on family law, and he says, you know, pluralistic regulation is what best serves the purposes of family law. And I said, well, what's the purpose of family law? And he said, well, that's protecting everyone. That's protecting the donors, protecting the surrogates, the gestational carriers, the birth parents, the adoptive parents, the patients. It's about protecting everyone, and when we look to regulate pluralistically, we look to serve everyone. And, you know, to me as a former teacher, that made a lot of sense, because it's a lot like differentiating instruction. When you differentiate, when you look to serve, you know, to serve people who are you know, challenged in one way or another, you actually wind up serving the whole classroom. So this this kind of regulation that he talks about, you know, or what Janie was mentioning, you know, preventing people from becoming gestational carriers, that means that people are not protected when they are seeking to build their families in that way, or when they are seeking to become gestational carriers. It means that they don't have laws protecting them.
Bell Boggs' book is called The Art of Waiting on Fertility Medicine and Motherhood. And Bell, thank you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me and for this opportunity.
Absolutely. Janie, so glad you could join the conversation. I want you to know we had several calls from people who were calling in to say they loved working with you. Shout-outs to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate being part of this dialogue and conversation. I absolutely love the book. So thank you. We're glad you were too.
Janie Jensen with us, a reproductive and infertility specialist at Mayo. Steph, one more thought on this from the page.
Jess says, preparing for infertility is like preparing for war, a war against your body, emotions, spouse, time, money, and your future. The stress accumulates. Every person's journey is different, but it's so difficult to really know until you are in it.
You can read about the book on the thread.